Hey, it's John Canzano. Thanks for listening to the podcast. Make sure you subscribe. And thanks to all the listeners and all of our sponsors who help make the Bald-Faced Truth the number one sports radio show in Portland. Enjoy.
Initialize sequence.
Welcome to the Baldcast, a production of John Canzano's Bald-Faced Truth.
I want you all to listen up. This is important stuff, all right?
John Canzano is on Sports Radio 750, The Game.
Okay. Here we go.
The Bald-Faced Truth.
Call 503-417-7575 or 877-733-0750 or text to 64636.
Here we go in 3, 2.
Now, in for John Canzano, here's Justin Myers on 750 and 1029 FM, The Game.
What a fantastic night of basketball last night. Blazers finally get off the snide and the losing streak. Get a big win at Moda Center without Damian Lillard, but about 2 hours down the road, Dylan Brooks hit what may have been the biggest shot in Oregon basketball history. I know. Biggest shot in Oregon basketball history. Welcome to the BFT. Happy Thursday, boys and girls. Lots of fun stuff coming up in the next 3 hours. We're going to be talking with Tyson Alger. He was down there in Eugene with me last night watching Oregon take down UCLA at Matthew Knight Arena. Also, George Schroeder from the USA Today. Is it USA Today or is it the USA Today? Did I just sound like my grandma?
I think it's just USA Today.
It's not the USA Today?
I always say USA Today. I begin where they capitalize it.
But like most newspapers, you throw, it's the Oregonian, the Register Guard.
The Google? Grandpa?
I just said newspapers, Kellen.
Oh, excuse me.
The New York Times. You ever heard of that one? You bearded millennial? So, I mean, is it USA Today or the USA Today? It sounds, actually, now that I'm saying it out loud, the USA Today sounds terrible.
Yeah, it doesn't sound right.
It sounds horrible. From USA Today, George Schroeder, good friend of mine, will be joining me in the second hour of the program. He is in Phoenix getting ready for Clemson and Ohio State. That's the second of the doubleheader coming up on New Year's Eve. And we'll talk a lot of college football stuff in the second hour of the program. And in particular, as Oregon fans out there, or even Oregon State fans, what do you want to see happen on Saturday? You got the Washington Huskies taking on the Alabama Crimson Tide. And I think most West Coast football fans, most West Coast college football fans, would probably like to see Alabama get upset. But would you like to see the upset at the hands of the Washington Huskies? So we'll talk about that coming up in the second hour of the program. Some Blazer talk in the third hour, and also an interesting question with regard. We've had a lot of food discussion in our pre-show, I don't even want to call it a meeting, just our pre-show ramblings. They're completely unorganized and completely abstract and all over the place, but we've been talking an awful lot about food because I think the majority of people that are involved in the show are just starving today. But something with LSU football and what they accomplished, and we're going to talk about the amount of hot wings that LSU ate the other day and whether or not anybody involved in this show could pull off the feat. So that's coming up in the third hour of the program. But we do have to open it up with Oregon basketball. The big win last night over UCLA. It has been less than 24 hours since Dylan Brooks hit the shot. But I think it is within argument to say that that may have been the biggest shot or the greatest shot in Oregon basketball history. I mean, it sounds a little bit ridiculous, and I know we all do that in college or in college sports or just in sports in general. But I've covered Oregon basketball for a long time. I grew up in Oregon. I've watched thousands of Oregon basketball games. Lots and lots of big shots, but I don't know of any that match up to the magnitude of what Dylan Brooks did last night. You hit a game winner at the buzzer while down against the number two team in the country. All in the middle of a season when you are one of the Pac-12 favorites and have high expectations of possibly making the Final Four. I can't think of another scenario in Oregon basketball where it's gotten bigger than that. So, I mean, let's all kind of sit down and break this down academically. What are the characteristics of a great shot, right? Obviously, first and foremost, it's got to be the game winner. Game tying shots are big. Game winning shots, step above. At the buzzer, and again, at the end of the game, there was about point, I would say, when I saw the replay, I thought it was about 0.5, 0.4 seconds left. They put 0.8 on. But, I mean, that's as close to a buzzer beater as you're going to get. I also think you elevate the level a little bit when you're behind. I know a lot of people brought up the 2007 Aaron Brooks shot against UCLA, and that was a tremendous shot. But that game was tied. There was also about 14 seconds left. So it wasn't the last shot of the game. They weren't behind. Still an incredibly big shot. And again, the part of this we won't know is where this season ends up. Because if this team ends up making it to the tournament, making a run to the Elite Eight, or maybe even to the Final Four, then yeah, you will look back and say, yeah, that may have been or was definitively the biggest shot in Oregon basketball history. 503-417-7575. Has there been a bigger shot that you can remember in Oregon? It's definitely the biggest shot in the history of Matthew Knight Arena. I mean, that I think is indisputable. But it was an unbelievable atmosphere last night. Oregon and UCLA put on a tremendous show. And we were talking about it yesterday with Austin Meek, and this he said before the game, and he was 100% correct, that it was going to be the biggest game in Matthew Knight Arena history. It's a short history, but it was. And the best part about it, it actually lived up to the hype. UCLA showed up. You knew it was going to be an up-and-down offensive ball game. Oregon went on their run in the first half. UCLA came back, went on their run in the second half. Some big missed free throws on both ends. I mean, at one point, Dylan Brooks missed four free throws in a row. And then you put Bryce Alford on the line, 1-1, with just seconds left on the clock, and all he has to do is hit two free throws. And he's one of the best free throw shooters in the Pac-12. Guy misses the front end of a 1-1. Dylan Brooks comes down, hammers a three-pointer. Oregon gets the biggest win in Matthew Knight Arena history. The way it all went down, the expectations that are on this team, continuing, by the way, the home winning streak, all of it adds up to, in my opinion, the biggest shot in Oregon basketball history. Because we're just talking about the shot itself. We can look back and say that Freddie Jones's shot against Texas in the NCAA tournament to push Oregon into the Elite Eight for the first time since the 30s. Maybe more important, but that wasn't at the buzzer. It wasn't in front of the home crowd. A lot of people probably don't even remember it all that much. Are buzzer beaters the best sports endings? I was thinking about that right before we went on the show. Because if we look at football, basketball, baseball, we could throw hockey in there as well because you've got penalty shots. But if you look at touchdown at the buzzer, a walk-off home run, or a game-winning three-pointer at the buzzer, is a basketball buzzer beater the best ending in all of sports? I look at the way that the whole play kind of worked itself out, and it's just so much tension. I mean, walk-off home runs are great, but the reason I think buzzer beaters are a little bit better, because there's no clock. There's no clock when it comes to a walk-off home run. It could be on the first pitch. It could be on the 10th pitch of the at-bat. Football is designed to set that up when you've got 1 second left or 3 seconds left and everybody knows it's the last play. But once the ball is snapped, you have all the time until somebody goes down. Something about a buzzer beater that just is way more exciting. Kellen, what do you think? If you were to go, the best way to end a game for your team, is it buzzer beater? Is it a touchdown, last second touchdown, or is it a walk-off home run?
No, it has to be the buzzer beater. I was raised on, you know, The Mighty Ducks, Miracle. All those movies come down to the wire. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, they're movies.
And I'm like General Patton. I love the smell of war. So watching I want my emotions to be peaks and valleys the whole game, but I want the win at the end. I don't want to go through all that rigmarole for a loss. The buzzer beater is the cherry on top.
Yeah, but you just mentioned two hockey movies.
True.
Is there ever really a buzzer beater in hockey? I mean, I don't know. I don't watch an awful lot of hockey. I can't imagine there's ever been a true, but I mean, there's been, we all know that against the Hawks that Conway was taken down from behind and he went with the triple deke to win the Pee Wee Championship for the Mighty Ducks. Like, we all know that, but does that count as a buzzer beater?
I can't think of any actual hockey buzzer beater.
I don't think so
either.
Now
that you bring it up.
I'm sure it happens, but it's either between a walk-off home run or a buzzer beater in basketball. I think it's really close. I kind of agree with you that basketball, because of the clock and because there's more moving parts, whereas in baseball, it's one pitch and one moment.
Yeah.
But I think that a walk-off home run can be one of the most dramatic things that happens in sports.
Okay, let me throw this out. Let's just say in baseball, walk-off home runs are incredibly exciting. But they're that whole, once the guy hits it, then it's over, and then basically it's all about the celebration. Is it more exciting for, let's say, a bases loaded single when you're down one? And then you get the guy scoring from second, the throw to the plate, waiting on the umpire's call.
Famous Griffey
play?
Yeah,
like the Griffey, the Edgar Martinez is done.
Yeah, I kind of see what you're saying. Like, in baseball, it's almost more the circumstances surrounding that moment that kind of comes to a head. But
instead of a last second touchdown, let's go Hail Mary. Like a Hail Mary play, true Hail Mary, from like behind the 50 versus a buzzer beater.
I still go buzzer beater.
I think so too. But the cool thing about last night, even though it wasn't an actual true buzzer beater, and I don't remember when the NBA started doing this, but when the NBA made the rule that you could advance the ball from timeouts, it kind of watered down the whole buzzer beater thing. Because you just, every close game, you're going to get a shot at the buzzer to tie or take the lead because you can always advance the ball. You could probably watch, if you have like NBA League Pass, you watch a slate of NBA games, you're going to see a shot at the end of the game. You get what, a Hail Mary, a legit Hail Mary once a season, maybe?
Well, yeah, and if you're the defender, all you got to do is bat the ball down. So it's very impressive when...
They never do, though. I know.
What's with that?
The dumbest thing ever.
There's like eight guys, and you know they have to do is get their hand on the ball, and someone still comes up with it. But, I mean, that's pretty exciting because of the fact that it's one throw and there's and everybody knows kind of what's coming. And if someone's still able to make the play, that's very exciting. But I don't know. There's something just very dramatic about the moment. And it's almost part of it is almost a setup. Like you look back at that Lillard shot against Houston.
Yes.
It's like you kind of know it has to go one way or the other. So when the guy gets the ball and makes that shot, I mean, it's hard to beat that.
The other cool thing about a buzzer beater that I think maybe puts it above, say, a Hail Mary, not above a walk-off home run, but maybe above a Hail Mary, is when the ball goes through, you know it. The Hail Mary, there's always kind of a scrum, and then you have to look at the replay or wait for the reaction, and then we got to review it 17 times. When you hit a buzzer beater and you bury that thing, everybody knows it. It was incredible last night, though. That was one of the best. I mean, I know I'm giving just loads and loads of hot takes in the first segment here. Like we are just scorching hot takes in the entire first segment. Greatest shot in Oregon basketball history. I think it is. I would love for some. I mean, I'm open to an argument here. I'm open to a discussion. But I think it was the best shot in Oregon basketball history. Just in a vacuum. You can always, and if this team continues on, wins the Pac-12, or gets a top four seed in the NCAA tournament, makes the Sweet 16, makes the Elite Eight, then yeah, this shot's going to definitely hold up. But I've already said that's the greatest shot in Oregon basketball history. Given all sorts of hot takes, left and right. But I don't know. I just think when you look at, especially in college basketball buzzer beaters, because you do most of the time have to go the length of the floor. You don't get to advance the ball. It was just an incredible atmosphere. And like I said, one of the best college basketball games, just because very rarely, because you're dealing with college kids and because they're 20, 21, that's just in life. When you're 20 and 21, just in life, you're inconsistent. Your good and your bad days are peaks and valleys. And then eventually you grow up and you find your little sweet spot, and your good days aren't always as great, but your bad days aren't always as down. But when you're in college, when you're in your 20s, your highs are really high and your lows are really low. And for that, it takes a long, it's a rare, I think, scenario when you put two great teams together and then it lives up to the hype. It just doesn't happen, especially in the regular season. But Oregon and UCLA, I think both put their best foot forward, both played tremendous basketball, and Oregon got out with a win. Needed a little bit of luck. Needed some things to break their way, but you know what? Oregon played far from a perfect game. But this was not only big, though, for Oregon. This was big for the Pac-12. You look at what UCLA has done this year. What? UCLA's beaten Kentucky. They beat Texas A&M. They have another big win on their schedule, too, that I can't think of off the top of my head. And, you know, Oregon, with a lot of hype earlier in the year, the loss to Baylor and the loss in Maui, kind of, I don't want to say didn't hurt the Pac-12, but you know, when your favorites kind of go down early, that perception sticks with a team. But this was big for the Pac-12 because they finally put a showcase game. Unfortunately, though, it was at 6 o'clock on a Wednesday in the middle of the dreaded dead week between Christmas and New Year's. By the way, we were trying to think of, like, does this shot need a name? I mean, Oregon sports is not that great when it comes to names. I know there's the pick, and that's the one. You got Kenny Wheaton's interception in 1994 against Washington. That's about it, though. I can think of a lot of great moments and great games in Oregon football and Oregon basketball. But they don't have an awful lot of great names. Like, does this shot need a name? And does it need to have like a Canadian twist? Because Dylan Brooks from Ontario. We've got 2.5 hours. Maybe we'll see if we can't figure out a name for the shot. Coming up next, though, we're going to talk with Tyson Alger of the Oregonian. He was there as well, and we will go over Oregon, big win against UCLA, what it means heading forward into the season, talk a little bit about USC as well. Big college football hour coming up in the second hour of the program. And I have to take Kellen to task at some point in the show because I saw something today and I kind of brushed it off. And the more and more I thought about it, the more upset I got. I take it back, Kellen. I'm not upset with you because I could never do that. You work really hard and you do a great job. I was a little bit disappointed with you earlier today.
I can't wait till we get into this because I think he's a genius.
Did the line between genius and madman is very, very thin, and I think he crossed it.
I tap dance on that line every day.
I was disappointed in you. So we'll talk about that coming up a little bit later as well. Tyson Alger, the Oregonian, though, joins me coming up next. It's the BFT. I'm Justin Myers sitting in for Canzano. 750, 1029 The Game.
This is the Bald-Faced Truth with guest host Justin Myers on 750 The Game.
Ducks have no timeouts left. Pritchard down court. Brooks with 3-2. Good! Oregon wins! Oregon wins! The three by Brooks is good!
Oh, when you can get Jerry Allen in like the third tier of the upper register, you know it's a good day for Oregon. Dylan Brooks with the game winner against UCLA, the number two team in the country. Was it the biggest shot in Oregon basketball history? And I'm just talking about a shot in a vacuum. Behind against the number two team in the country with seconds on the clock. Some of the highest expectations coming into the season. It's definitely in the argument. It's in the discussion. And we'll continue the discussion with Tyson Alger. He was there with me last night as the Ducks took down the Bruins. Tyson Alger from the Oregonian. Welcome to the show. How you doing, man?
Hey, I'm doing great, man. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. So let's go back to last night and just... Let's talk about the performance of Oregon basketball. Was that the best this team has played wire to wire all season long?
I think hands down. I mean, as long as you don't include like a game against like Savannah State, uh-huh. which is just, not a quality opponent unless, you're talking to Oregon State. But I digress. But against a good opponent, that was by far the most complete game you've seen from Oregon. The Ducks have kind of had a habit this year of taking their time to get into games. They played pretty poorly in the first half, and frankly, you just can't do that against UCLA. They're the most efficient offense in the country. They came in averaging like 96 points per game, and basically, if Oregon didn't have their stuff together from the get-go, they were going to get lapped. And that first half, that was one of the more entertaining first halves of basketball I've seen all year. Just both teams coming out firing. The Ducks were shooting lights out, and their ball movement was far superior to anything they've put on display this year. So just being able to have kind of their complete lineup in there healthy for the first time. I know Chris Boucher was still a little banged up, but that was the Oregon team out there that, everyone predicted that, was a preseason top five team, preseason Pac-12 favorite. That was the team there playing for the first time this season.
You know, Tyson, every time I've been around Dana Altman, the guy always talks about defense and defense over and over and over again. But you look at what this team was able to do last night. Now, granted, UCLA defensively has an awful lot of weaknesses, but I wonder if we look maybe a little bit ahead and what's going to happen the rest of the season. Is this Oregon team going to be maybe the most offensive team we've seen from Dane Altman?
It's got a really good chance of it. And, the amazing thing about this team, as you mentioned, is it's still kind of clicking a little bit. It's the, the Ducks have really been kind of struggling to find their offensive chemistry just with some of the new guards in the rotation like Dylan Ennis and Peyton Pritchard, and the fact that Brooks has only been starting for the last three games now, and then Boucher being injured. Oregon's defense has really been playing better than its offense as of late, and that's not really something that you hear from a Dana Altman team this early. The one thing Altman has been telling us is that, hey, I'm not so worried about the offense. They're going to find their rhythm. The team's a better shooting team than they've shown so far, and you kind of started to see that last night where, and you know, UCLA, like you said, is not a great defensive team, but Oregon was definitely pressuring them. They found their weaknesses. Dylan Brooks, you know, was just able to put his head down and bully his way to the basket numerous times. And, you know, this is a team that has pretty much a scoring threat 1 through 5 out of the starting lineup. So they're really, I would imagine they're going to really start clicking here over the coming weeks.
Tyson Alger of the Oregonian joining me here on the BFT. We're talking Oregon and the big win over UCLA last night. And let's talk about Dylan Brooks. He's continuing to try to get back into rhythm. I think this is a pretty good indication that I think he's found it. But I don't know about you. I was really surprised when I looked at the stats after the game and saw that he was the leading scorer with 23 points. And maybe it just goes to the expectations, but it looked as though he wasn't having a very efficient offensive night. And then at the end of the game, he had 23 points and scored the game winner. I mean, he seems to be clicking maybe a little bit faster than a lot of people are realizing. And I think we may have lost Tyson. Tyson, are you there? Have we lost you?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm here. You know, that's kind of the thing you see with Dylan Brooks' game is a lot of times you'll be watching and you won't see a whole lot of them, but he'll still have about 5 or 6 points, in the first half. And that's kind of what happened yesterday. And then he just gets on hot streaks and he can score points in bunches and start to take over a game. So while he kind of seemed like he wasn't kind of in it in that first half, you know, he still had decent numbers. It was just quiet, and then he gets loud later on. And so, I think he struggled a little bit in his role coming off the bench from that injury because, you know, this is a guy who has started pretty much every game since he came in as a freshman. So I think he was adjusting to that bench role. But, he's back in the starting lineup now. I think the game is starting to kind of come back to him. And, he's coming off of off-season foot surgery, and we've seen those surgeries take a lot more time for players to get back into a rhythm than it's taken with Brooks. Jordan Bell missed the complete first half of the season last year. Dylan Ennis pretty much missed the whole season last year. So the Ducks really wanted to take their time with this. They had him on a minutes restriction up until a couple of games ago, and it seems like they're kind of finally taking the safety provisions away from him and letting him finally go out there and play.
You know what was what I think stood out last night, Tyson, was the play of Peyton Pritchard, because I know at the beginning of the season, a lot of people probably assumed that he's going to get some significant minutes because of Brooks's injury. But once Brooks comes back, there'd be more of a veteran rotation. But you have seen Peyton Pritchard establish a spot on this team, and not just the three that he hit when Oregon was down 4, but he hit some very, very big shots in that stretch run in the second half, and he's playing an awful lot more mature than I think a freshman has played in Oregon in a long time.
Oh, I completely agree with you. You know, this is a kid who's already going to go down in Oregon lore as one of the best high school players in history, so people were familiar with him. I was pretty surprised at how quickly he's made an impact here. You know, I thought he was talented. I thought he was going to have a chance at having a really good Oregon career. But just the poise and kind of maturity he's shown so far as a freshman has been pretty outstanding. I mean, just looking at yesterday's game down the stretch, he hit that money three. I was really impressed with two crucial free throws he made down the stretch when everyone else was missing them. And the fact that, you know, this is the guy, I believe he finished with 9 assists last night. He sees the floor incredibly well. He has an incredible handle. This is a kid that, you know, came out, took a starting spot from Casey Benson, who, you know, Benson's not the flashiest player, but he's really, really efficient and no Dana Altman's offense. And basically Pritchard came in and earned the trust of a guy like Altman, who sometimes it takes time to earn Dana Altman's trust on the floor. And he's definitely done that and proven that he's not only going to be a threat for the future, he's a big piece of this team right now.
I mean, I know that the shot he hit with, I think it was around 17 seconds left. Oregon was down 3 at the time, right before they had to foul. making the shot was one thing, Tyson, but man, for a freshman to grab the ball and it was contested and it was a deep three, just to put that shot up, I thought was very impressive.
Well, you know, he puts a shot up and then Oregon calls the timeout and then they foul Alford and then bring it with no timeouts left. Oregon had to unexpectedly rebound that ball. Alford's like an 87% career free throw shooter. So that was a surprise. Pritchard brings the ball up court and initiates that play to Brooks, too. So, I mean, he was in on every key play for the Ducks last night.
Tyson Alger of the Oregonian. We're talking Oregon and UCLA. And obviously, a lot of great stuff to talk about with the game. And wire to wire, it has been the most the best game that Oregon has played all season. The only thing where I'd say a big concern maybe going down the road is the defense down low. And UCLA seemed to be able to grab a bucket in that second half down low whenever they wanted to. Where do you think is that because of Boucher maybe being a little bit hobbled and them struggling a little bit with front court defense?
Yeah, you know, I think that was it. That was a really surprising game for Oregon down low because, you know, this is a team that has pretty much been averaging close to 10 blocks per game coming in, and they only had one last night, and that was by, I think it was Boucher, it was either Boucher or Bell pretty late in the game. It was just kind of surprising. Boucher was a relatively non-factor, and you just didn't kind of see some of the flying around and swarming that you usually see with him and Jordan Bell, so... you know, that was kind of a bit of a concern last night because guys like TJ Leaf and Welsh were basically getting those low post, you know, baseline shots like it was nobody's business. I mean, they were incredibly efficient doing that. So that's definitely something they're going to have to shore up. I do think Boucher wasn't quite 100% in that game. And, he's been kind of their rock so far while Brooks has been coming back. So I think that may have disrupted that a little bit. But, you know, for as kind of vulnerable as they looked at times in that position, they still did limit UCLA to below UCLA season average. You know, this is a decent Oregon defensive team, so I don't think that's going to be a huge worry going forward.
Tyson Alger of the Oregonian joining me here on the BFT. We're talking Oregon, the big win against UCLA last night. And really everything, as we mentioned, just started to click with this Oregon team. And I know getting healthy is a big reason and kind of getting back into that rotation. But the one thing I've always been very impressed with Tyson with Dana Altman teams is they have always seemed to have gotten better as the season goes along. And I think that was another example. This looked like a much better team, granted with players healthy and in particular Brooks, but this looked like a much better team than we saw 2-3 weeks ago against Baylor and in Maui.
Oh, I completely agree with you. I think this is even a much better looking team than we saw, you know, a week and a half ago against UNLV and Fresno State. You know, that's kind of the one kind of calling card of a Dana Altman team is, you know, they may take an occasional lump or two during the non-conference schedule, but it seems like everything has its purpose. And, you know, Oregon looked really bad in that Baylor game. They looked really bad against Georgetown. You know, those weren't, well, granted, the Baylor loss looks completely fine now. They'll probably be the number two team in the country next week, but it just kind of came out flat against Georgetown and lost that neutral court game. But, you know, you can go back and look at last season. They lost at UNLV. They lost at Boise State. And then that was a team that ended up coming in and winning the Pac-12 tournament and earning a number one seed. So, comparatively speaking, the losses this year weren't as bad as last year. And that was a Oregon team that really turned the corner to Pac play. And now you're looking at this team, one game in the Pac-12, you have a win over the number two team in the country. That looks like a Dana Altman team right there.
Looking ahead to Friday night's game, USC is coming in. USC's undefeated, but they haven't really played anybody. I don't know if you can take anything from the game last night against Oregon State. I think the way that the Pac-12, Tyson, schedules their games, and Oregon State, let's just be honest, they're just bad. I mean, they're a bad basketball team. They're going to struggle, I think, to win games in the conference. You wonder, like, how that may affect Oregon because the Pac-12 still decides to schedule in pairs, and a team like USC doesn't have to play their best game against Oregon State the night before, and then they're going to be able to come in hot against Oregon on Friday.
Yeah, you know, you're absolutely right with USC in that they haven't really played anybody yet. You know, they've done everything that's been asked of them so far this year, and that's why they're undefeated coming into this game, and they deserve their top 25 ranking, but they just haven't played a team at the quality of Oregon. Now, here's what's going to be interesting, though, is just with so much hype from that UCLA game, you know, it was a big build up into that game as the Pac-12 opener sold out house. He ended up winning on a game-winning three-pointer. I think it's going to be an interesting test to see just how Oregon turns around from kind of the momentum of that game to face, you know, still a really good USC team. You know, I think Oregon is a much better team than USC. I think Oregon will win that game, but just that's a quick turnaround to face another top 25 team, especially when you're coming off such an emotional high against UCLA. You know, I didn't see much of the USC Oregon State game last night. I don't think you can really take a whole lot away from it because Oregon State's not very good to begin with, and they are injured too. So, you know, it's kind of been an unfortunate start for the Beavers so far, coming off of their really nice NCAA tournament season last year. But, you know, it should be another good game Friday night at Matthew Knight.
Are you calling for the dreaded trap game? Is that what it is? The look ahead trap game?
You know, I think it might be a little bit too early for a trap game. I think I think having a top 25 ranking kind of helps seal that. You know, USC isn't coming in with a whisper here, so I think Altman will have that team ready. You know, it's just it seems like a lot of people were relatively down on this Ducks team, kind of. After those two losses early in the season, you know, everyone kind of thought that Oregon basketball was going to be the savior after that really bad football season. And it seemed like some of that momentum was taken away. And, you know, they kind of quietly won 9 straight games there. And now after this game on Wednesday, it kind of just feels like everything's back in play in terms of the high end.
All right. Tyson Alger of the Oregonian covers Oregon basketball. Appreciate the time, Tyson. We'll talk to you down the road, man.
Thanks,
all right, there you go. Tyson Alger was at the ball game at MKA last night. Oregon with the win. And, you know, the one thing that a lot of people, and it's easy to forget, and I think, again, you go back to what I was talking about yesterday. And if you weren't listening yesterday, what the heck were you doing with your day? But yesterday I mentioned that I think college basketball does itself a disservice by starting the season in November. You start the season in November. Early on, you're swallowed up by football. Nobody's paying attention. And with Oregon and what Tyson was saying, Oregon football was such a disappointment this year that a lot of fans then turned and said, well, Oregon basketball is going to be the savior. And they took an early loss to Baylor, another loss to Georgetown, and a lot of people kind of felt like the air was let out of the season. But if you go back and you look at Dana Altman teams, every single one of them plays better in February and March than they do in November and December. And you can't always say that for college basketball teams. There's plenty of Washington, for example, Lorenzo Romar is the king of looking great in December and then completely falling apart when you get into conference play. Last year, Oregon lost a couple of non-conference games. Remember how Oregon started the Pac-12 season a year ago, by the way? Took a double-digit loss. Double-digit loss to Oregon State. But then what happened? They continued to get better. And by the time March rolled around, they won the Pac-12, were a number one seed heading into the tournament. Never happened before. And why is that? Because almost every single year that Dana Altman has taken over Oregon, they are playing so much better in February and March than they do at the beginning of the season. And you saw that last night. Yes, Dylan Brooks is back. He's healthy. But that team was so much better than the team we saw against Baylor earlier in the season. Team was so much better than what we saw in Maui, losing to Georgetown, going to overtime against a Tennessee team that they probably should have handled. You want to talk about what Dana Altman does better than maybe anybody else in the conference? His teams are constantly getting better. Week by week, month by month, and by March, it looks like a completely different team. It's happened every single year. Coming up next in the second hour of the program, I want to talk about the college football playoff. George Schroeder is going to join me at the bottom of the hour. He is in Phoenix getting ready for the Fiesta Bowl, which is one half of the four-team playoff in college football. The other half, though, very intriguing, I think, for Oregon and Pac-12 fans. Are you pulling for the Huskies to get the upset against Alabama? Can you even bring yourself to do that as an Oregon or even an Oregon State fan? We'll talk about that coming up next. Justin Myers in for Canzano. It's the BFT 750 1029 The Game.
Something is about to happen.
BFT.
Now listen up, everyone.
Let's go. The bald-faced truth.
John Canzano.
John Canzano is on The Game.
I gotta say, I love him most of the time. I think he's right on.
He's okay.
John's great.
He's a little unusual.
Live every afternoon, 12 to 3 p.m.
I hate that guy because he just never knows what he's talking about.
I think he does a damn good job.
That's my dude, man. Yeah, I know him, man. I let my mother listen to him.
Now, in for John Canzano, here's Justin Myers on 750 and 1029 FM, The Game.
It's a big night of basketball last night here in the state of Oregon. Blazers get off the snide by getting a win over the Kings. And the Oregon Ducks take down the number two team in the country, 89-87, down at Matthew Knight Arena on a last-second three-pointer by Dylan Brooks. I just threw out the argument, threw out the discussion. Is that the best shot in Oregon basketball history? Was it the biggest shot in Oregon basketball history? It seems ridiculous to say so now. But if you go back and look, Oregon basketball has had bigger wins, more important wins. But if you look at the history of Oregon basketball, they haven't had that many big shots. And that's why I brought it up. They've been to three Elite Eights. Listen, I'm not going to say a Pac-12 win on December the 28th is the greatest win in Oregon basketball history. That's not what I'm saying. Winning the Pac-12, going to three Elite Eights, those are all bigger wins. They've also beaten UCLA when they were the number one team in the country a couple of times. But there's not an awful lot of big shots. That's why I brought it up. Look at it in a vacuum as a shot. Oregon's hit some game winners, but they were never as significant as beating the number two team in the country at home. Aaron Brooks hit a big shot in 2007 against UCLA. That game was tied, though, and it wasn't a buzzer beater. But I threw it out on Twitter, and man, a lot of cold water being thrown on my hot take. I don't know what it is. I don't know what it is with the mean tweets, but it's just an awful lot of cold water being thrown on my hot take today. But I'll tell you what. Nobody can name a bigger shot. Can't name one. I think it's one of those things that it sounds weird less than 24 hours after. Bill Walton was calling the game last night. He is the king, the absolute king of, oh, that was the worst pass in Oregon basketball history. That's the greatest two-minute stretch that Oregon has ever put together. But if you really sit down and think about it and go over the history of Oregon basketball, it's in the argument. It's in the discussion. The only other shots that I can think of that are in the discussion with regards to what happened last night, Aaron Brooks' shot in 2007. Freddie Jones hit a shot to beat Texas in the Sweet 16 to go to the Elite Eight, really for the first time since the tournament expanded to 64 teams for Oregon, when the Sweet 16 actually meant something. Joe Young hit, I think, like a 35-footer at the buzzer to win a Pac-12 tournament game. All in the argument, all in the discussion, and I'm not saying it's definitive, but don't discount what happened last night at Matthew Knight Arena. That was a massively, massively big moment. So a lot of great stuff in basketball. Big stuff, by the way, coming up this weekend in football. For the second year in a row, college football is going to try to to play their final four games on New Year's Eve. It was a complete and utter flop a year ago. This year, I think it's a little bit different because you get the games are going to be on Saturday in the middle of the day. People are more used to just watching college football on Saturday. But last year, when they were trying to run the final four games on New Year's Eve, it just didn't work. Ratings were abysmal. But it's an interesting situation for both, I think, Oregon and Oregon State fans. What do you want to see in the Alabama-Washington game as an Oregon fan or as a Washington fan or as an Oregon State fan? What do you want to see in that game? Now, Washington, one of Oregon's biggest rivals. So you figure, oh, you would want to see Washington get blown out. But they're facing Alabama. Not only are they facing Alabama, but they're facing what Alabama represents. That is SEC arrogance. It seems like each and every year, the Pac-12 has to battle the SEC or the South and their arrogance of college football. A couple of years ago, it was Oregon against Florida State. Now it's Washington. As an Oregon fan, are you willing to put your blind hatred of Washington aside for maybe the greater good of West Coast football, striking down SEC arrogance? Could you even bring that to yourself? This would be, for Oregon fans, this would be much easier if it was any other team in the conference. But it is Washington. Is there anything good as an Oregon fan or even an Oregon State fan? But as an Oregon fan, is there anything good that can come of Saturday's game between Washington and Alabama? Let's go to TJ. TJ is in Tigard. You're on the BFT. What's on your mind?
Yeah, so thinking about the Alabama-Washington game, like you said, if it was anybody else that Washington was playing, I would hope that Washington would lose, because I'm an Oregon fan, and yeah. So the thing that bothers me the most, I like Chris Peterson. I think he's a really good coach, but he's also pretty humble and pretty sociable, and that's the one thing that grinds my gears about Alabama is Urban Meyer has gotten to the stage where...
You mean Nick Saban?
Sorry. Nick Saban's gotten to the stage where, you know, he can just say whatever he wants to the media and they know it's just Nick Saban being Nick Saban. But I would actually prefer Washington... Sounds awful. Tastes awful coming out of my mouth. I would actually prefer Washington to beat Alabama just because of, like you said, the SEC bias, SEC arrogance.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing that's going to bother me is if they do, then all of the Washington fans that have come out of the woodwork this last year are going to be right up there with the arrogance of the Alabama fans. But if we all remember when Chris Peterson was at Boise State, they played in the Fiesta Bowl against Oklahoma Sooners team that was not going to be beaten by Boise State. And when Chris Peterson was given the opportunity to win the game, he did. If Chris Peterson has the capability of winning a game against anybody, I would take Chris Peterson. Now, the question is, will Washington be hanging around until the fourth quarter with Alabama?
I mean, TJ, I appreciate the phone call. I'd be very surprised. I'd be very surprised if Washington's hanging around. I mean, just this a couple of years ago, we thought Alabama was loaded then, and Ohio State took it to them. And Ohio State ended up beating Oregon and going on to win the national championship. Something weird happens between the final game of the college football season and New Year's. And that's a weird month. Some teams just absolutely thrive. Some teams completely fall apart. Washington State, by the way, pretty good example of that. Now, TJ brought up an interesting point because I said that Washington is not just facing Alabama. They're facing what Alabama represents. And for West Coast football fans, you need to take this seriously. Alabama represents SEC arrogance, East Coast bias, everything that the Pac-12 has to deal with. I mean, the simple fact that Washington, winner of the Pac-12, with one loss, and its only loss was to USC, another team that was in the top 10, was even in the discussion or in the debate of not getting into the top four because of an anti-West Coast bias in college football. It exists. It's real. The only way you can overcome that is for West Coast teams to beat SEC teams, Big Ten teams. But there's another level of arrogance that we're dealing with here. And trust me, I spent the last 2 years of my life in Seattle. I was surrounded by purple and gold. The Husky fans are partying like it's 1989 again. The Husky arrogance of the late 80s and the early 90s. Trust me, they win this game against Alabama. It will be unbearable. Unbearable. So which is the lesser of two evils? As an Oregon fan, as a West Coast football fan, but in particular, all of us here within the state of Oregon, what is the lesser of two evils? Is it SEC East Coast arrogance? Or is it the emerging Washington fans dusting off their 1991 half national championship gear and thinking that they are the elite power on the West Coast again? I'm not saying it's going to be an easy choice as an Oregon fan. It's got to be an awful tough choice. Because if Oregon wants to get back into the mix national title-wise, which is where Oregon is as a program, you have one bad year, you fire your coach, you have established yourself as a team that is going to be playing for and searching for national championships. So if you want to get back into the championship mix, then you have to find, you need the Pac-12 to be a respectable league. And it's not respected right now. The only way you can get respect is if you go in and win in the playoff. Let's go to Greg. Greg is in Portland. You're on the BFT. What's on your mind, Greg?
Yeah, just chiming in on the what we want out of this game. Longtime Oregon Duck fan, cannot stand the Huskies. So any Washington fan listening, I hate to burst your bubble on hoping that they're going to pull out a win, but not going to happen. Alabama is going to pummel them. They're not going to stay in the game. They're just too good. Alabama is way too good. Washington doesn't have a chance.
All right, great.
Namely, they haven't played anybody this season at all. So that's the reason they look so good the entire season. I guess, you know, Colorado was their claim to fame, but I think they're going to be pleasantly dissatisfied with the results.
All right, Greg, I appreciate the phone call. Thanks for calling in. Look, I disagree that Washington hasn't played anybody. They played the entire Pac-12 schedule. They lost one game to USC. USC is a pretty good team. They beat Colorado. They beat Utah. They put 70 points on Oregon. I mean, they did what they were supposed to do. You look at what Washington has done this year. Outside of the USC game, they won significantly over the rest of their opponents in the Pac-12. They did what you're supposed to do. But what arrogance is the lesser of the two evils here? As a Northwest football fan, as a fan of either Oregon or Oregon State, and I think this probably, I mean, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. I think Oregon State and Washington fans, while they will never agree that they are kind of They're allies. It may be a little bit of an unspoken agreement. Look, you don't mess with us, we won't mess with you. But you know that if Washington goes into this game on Saturday, gets their doors blown off by a physically superior Alabama team, guess what that's going to mean? Typical West Coast, soft, small football. You can't win in the trenches, can't play with the big boys. Never mind that nobody could play with Alabama this year. If you are an Oregon fan, can you put your hatred of Washington aside for the greater good, for the conference? Personally, I've never been a fan of rooting for the conference. I don't understand it. I don't understand the mentality. It's one of those things that only happens in college football. I mean, if you're a fan of the Blazers, you're not rooting for the division, are you? If you're a Seahawk fan, you're not rooting for the 49ers when they're playing other teams, or rooting for the Rams when they're playing other teams. It is a solely college football mentality when you start rooting for your conference. I've never understood it. But if the Pac-12 is going to get back to respectability, or maybe even gain some respectability that it just doesn't have nationwide, and it doesn't, Washington has to win this game. Let's go to John. John is in Hillsboro. Welcome to the BFT, John. What's on your mind?
Hey, well, I wanted to say that I am an Oregon alumni. I also went to the University of Southern California, and I am a strong Pac-12 supporter.
Uh-huh.
And even though we're opponents of Washington, I'm wishing them all the best this weekend against Alabama.
All right, John, hey, I appreciate the phone call.
The credibility of the Pac-12 is riding on this game, I think, and we really need to root for Washington to win.
Okay. Fantastic. Thanks for the phone call, John. I think this is going to be one of those things where when you sit here and talk about it on a Thursday, the idea of the respectability of the Pac-12 and the idea of West Coast football gaining a level of national respect, because trust me, if Washington goes in and beats Alabama, that would be the biggest win for the Pac-12, I don't know, maybe since it expanded to 12 teams. I mean, the Pac-12 hasn't had that many significant wins. I mean, the biggest win for the Pac-12, at least in terms of bowl season over the past probably 5-6 seasons, is what, Oregon over Florida State? But you look at all the big games that Oregon was in, couldn't hang with the big offensive linemen, couldn't hang in the trenches. Let's go to Don. Don is in Wilsonville. Don, welcome to the show. What's on your mind?
Well, I was thinking, Washington is our little brother, and we've dominated them for a year, so we might as well just say, I hope my little brother does good. The fact that there's plenty to, if you put it on a list, reasons why you want to root for the Pac-12, the conference, is because the FB always gets everything they want, mm-hmm. and if they win, it would actually be a miracle if they win, because this is the best Alabama team in probably recent years, a lot of most pundits say. But if they have a chance to win, I wouldn't call that the Washington Husky fans arrogance, because really, back in 1990, that's the last time they had any glory. So it'd be almost excitement. Oregon fans are pretty much arrogant in the sense that they feel like they were entitled. Now they're humbled, and now they have to rework the system. This system with Huskies, they worked for it, and now they're at a point where they're not really arrogant. They're almost too excited to know that they're in this place.
All right. Hey, Don, appreciate the phone call. Thanks for calling in. I'll tell you right now, though, the Washington arrogance is a very real thing. It really is. They were mediocre to bad for the last 10 years. Mediocre to bad. They've had an 0-12 season in that span. Haven't made a significant presence in the Pac-12, and guess what? It took them 1 year. They think they're back. And I'll tell you what, if they beat Alabama, it's going to be unbearable. It is. It's going to be absolutely unbearable. We're going to continue the college football discussion. George Schroeder from USA Today is going to be joining me. He is in Phoenix getting ready for the Fiesta Bowl, but we're going to talk about the Final Four, some other college football topics. Coming up next, it's the BFT. Justin Myers in for Canzano, 750, 1029 The Game.
Back to the BFT with guest host Justin Myers on 750 The Game.
It was a fun night on the hardwood in the state of Oregon as the Blazers and the Ducks get wins. Oregon wins in an incredibly exciting fashion. Last second three by Dylan Brooks. But college football playoff is coming up this weekend. New Year's Eve, you got the Final Four, and George Schroeder from USA Today is now joining me here on the BFT. He's in Phoenix. He'll be covering the Fiesta Bowl featuring Ohio State and Clemson. George, good to talk to you, man. How you doing?
Man, I'm great. It's 80 degrees Paradise Valley, Arizona, and it's 52 degrees in Atlanta and about to start raining, which is why I'm at the Fiesta Bowl, not the Peach Bowl. Just want to let you know.
It is 40 degrees and foggy in Portland today, so thank you.
It's wintertime in Oregon, man.
That's true, yeah. So a gorgeous 80 degrees, and I'm sure you're enjoying all the great Fiesta Bowl perks being there in Phoenix. But I do want to start with Alabama because, you know, coming into the playoff, George, all the accolades going to Alabama, a lot of people saying this could be the best that Nick Saban has had in his tenure there, which says an awful lot. You've seen them play. Is this the best Alabama team we've seen in the Nick Saban era?
I don't think we know for two reasons. One, first of all, they're fantastic, okay? Their defense is maybe the best in the Nick Saban era. Their offense is frankly pedestrian. Although Jalen Hurts has injected a different level of danger, the true freshman quarterback, the first dual threat guy they've really had. No offense to Blake Sims, no disrespect intended to him. But I don't think we really know because, and this is sacrilege, I understand this in college football, but the SEC is completely down around Alabama. It's not the same SEC of 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years ago when the team that emerged, most usually Alabama, had been incredibly battle-tested. That's just not the case for these guys. Now, that said, I do think they're probably the best team in the country. Here's what's about to happen, though. In Washington, which has gotten no real shot in the run-up to the playoff of winning this, at least people have acted like they have no shot. But in Washington, Alabama's going to play the best team it's played all year.
Really?
Assuming it beats Washington, and a lot of people will assume that, then in the Fiesta Bowl winter, Alabama is going to play the best team it's played all year. Mm-hmm. And do I think Alabama's going to win it? I actually picked Clemson to win in part because I was just looking to be a little bit different. I think Alabama's the safe pick and maybe the right pick. But we should not be surprised. I would be mildly surprised if Washington beat them. I won't be surprised if the Ohio State-Clemson winner beats them. Like I said, Alabama's the right pick. But they're about to run into teams they haven't played all year. And that's just the way it is. It's not the same old SEC, and it takes a while for us to get that out of our minds. But you can watch the early bowl games and see that. In Kansas, Texas A&M was supposed to be a giant test for Alabama. You remember that back in late October, early November? They just got beaten by a decidedly mediocre Kansas State team. A decidedly mediocre Kansas State team that finished middle of the pack in the Big 12. Remember how down the Big 12 supposedly is?
Mm-hmm.
South Carolina is currently getting run by South Florida in the Birmingham Bowl. Now, those are mediocre bowls. There's some other things going on. But, you know, every other team in the SEC had 4 losses. The only reason that there's another team, Auburn, in a New Year's Six Bowl is because the Sugar Bowl is contractually obligated to take an SEC team. Otherwise, you wouldn't have seen anybody but Alabama in the New Year's Six. So, is Alabama fantastic? Yes. Are they probably the best team in the country? I do think so. Were they tested like Clemson was, like Ohio State was, to a slightly lesser degree, like Washington was. I don't think they were.
Yeah, it's interesting, George, because in we see this each and every year, and it's funny how we kind of our memories kind of play tricks on us. But funny things seem to happen from the end of the regular season and then in December and that layoff. And with Alabama, this may be something, it may be nothing, and so that's why I'm going to ask you. But Lane Kiffin took another job. He's going to finish out and be the offensive coordinator for the Crimson Tide in the game. But Lane Kiffin is now the head coach of a different football team. Does that kind of play like just a little bit of an X factor, a variable heading into the playoff?
Oh, sometimes. So I don't know how you know, and I think that varies by the person. But, you know, 2 years ago, Tom Herman was Ohio State's offensive coordinator. He took the job at Houston and stayed through the playoff. And, you know, they were fantastic. They beat Alabama, and then they beat Oregon, you know, and they didn't show any signs that had bothered them at all, that he was trying to do two jobs. You know, Luke Fickell, one of their co-defense coordinators, is trying to do the same thing for Ohio State this year. There's no way to know if that's going to be an issue or not. I don't think you know until you see it happen. Could it be different? Yeah, I think it could. I will say this, though. Alabama's strength is undeniably the defense, and there won't be any change there in terms of Jeremy Pruitt still there as a defense coordinator, Nick Saban still all over the defense. So, I mean, I actually think had you had some giant change on the defensive staff, that might have had a better shot of causing them troubles. The offense for Alabama is a good offense, but it's not great. It's not the thing that drives the team.
Talking with George Schroeder, USA Today college football writer, joining me here on the BFT. And let's get into the game that you are at. You're going to be covering Ohio State and Clemson. You said you picked Clemson to win. And, you know, Clemson is one of those weird teams, George, that has been at the top of the rankings all year long, goes undefeated, was in the title game a year ago, but just it never seemed like it had that big signature punch somebody in the mouth win. How would you compare this year's Clemson to last year's team that went all the way to the final game?
I would say this. They remind me an awful lot in some ways with the 2015 Ohio State team. With a couple of very important differences. You remember the 2015 Ohio State team had all these expectations laid upon them. Now, of course, they were a unanimous number one going into the 2015 season. That's not the case with Clemson. You know, Alabama was everybody's favorite mm-hmm. number one, and that's fine. But they had all these, they had the similar expectations as that Ohio State team in terms of everybody expecting them to get all the way back to the playoff because they brought back a ton of people, especially once you realize that they had reloaded on defense, Clemson had, and not rebuilt. And so I think they struggled with the weight of those expectations. They would disagree with that publicly, but I think if you injected truth serum into them, they would agree with that. The real big difference is, and I think these are good things, is one, they weren't coming off a national title, so they at least had the motivation of getting so close last year and not getting there. And then, two, when they took their loss, unlike Ohio State a year ago, it wasn't to a division rival. It didn't knock them out of the conference championship race, and it didn't knock them out of the playoff. So they took that loss to Pittsburgh. And I think you've seen, by and large, that since that loss, they've played a lot better. They still haven't put it all together, though. But if they do, I really believe Clemson is the kind of team, especially if you look at what they did last year, that is built to play pound for pound, man for man with Alabama and give them fits. And I really think that's the case. Ohio State is similar, but not quite as talented, I don't think.
You know, it's interesting with Dabo Swinney at Clemson. Obviously, the top of the mountain in college football is Urban Meyer and Nick Saban, and rightly so. I mean, those guys have got handfuls of championships and at multiple schools. But I wonder, with what Clemson has been able to do the last couple of years and what Dabo Swinney has been able to build there, because if you go back to when he got the job, it wasn't as if Clemson was an absolute power and he just took over an already kind of runaway freight train. Does Dabo Swinney get, I think, the credit maybe he deserves as a head coach nationwide?
Oh, maybe, probably not. I mean, probably people see him as a little bit of a caricature of himself because he's, you know, he doesn't take himself too seriously and he laughs. He's able to laugh at himself and, you know, he stresses having fun, whereas some of these other guys, in fact, all three of the other guys in this playoff sort of are the typical sort of joyless coaches, at least on the outside they seem to be, whereas Clemson sort of emphasizes the fun. But look, it's clear he's taken Clemson from good to great, to use sort of a cliche. I think that's true. I mean, I don't think there's any doubt about that. I think Tommy Bowden had them consistently good. Dabo Swinney has taken them to something that's approaching consistently great. But until you win a national title, and I guess that's if and until you win a national title, you're not going to be probably seen as a top three or four or five coach in the country. And I think that's the way it is. I mean, you know, is he a top 10 guy? Absolutely. If they win the national title, he will shoot right up there with them. You did mention this, though, by the way. If Ohio State wins the whole thing,
yes,
then we have to look at – we have to go back and look at things a little bit differently. They will have won two out of three if they can pull it off, win the Fiesta Bowl, win the national title. When they will have won two out of three. We know what a near miss they had last year when they just couldn't quite pull it off against – you know, they had a tough season trying to live up to those expectations I was talking about a minute ago. They lost, and then they lost a bad performance against Michigan State. And then we saw against Michigan and in the Fiesta Bowl against Notre Dame just how good they were. You would look at them and go, wow, what has Urban Meyer built? By the way, he's 61-5 at Ohio State. And if they win the whole thing, and they easily could, then all of a sudden you've got competing dynasties going, and you've got Urban Meyer at 52 years old. I think he's 52. And you're thinking, he's still just getting started. He may end up overtaking Nick Saban, who may be the best coach of all time right now. He may end up overtaking him before his career ends. I mean, it's just kind of interesting, all the little potential storylines that could pivot beyond just the Alabama wins its fifth in 8 years and that kind of thing.
George Schroeder, USA Today, joining me here on the BFT. I want to stick with what you were saying there with Urban Meyer, because you're right, George. It is an incredible story. When you look at Nick Saban, I mean, it's not that there's any clear path to becoming the greatest college football coach ever, but you know, Nick Saban started as a defensive coach in the NFL, then went to Michigan State, LSU, failed attempt at the NFL, then went to a powerhouse program, wasn't at the time, but built Alabama back up to its glory. Urban Meyer has that interesting little like hiccup in his career where he was one of the best coaches in football, had Florida as one of the top five teams year in and year out in college football, and then a very dangerous health scare, a year on ESPN, and then was able to do it all over again at Ohio State. I mean, it really is a phenomenal story for Urban Meyer to get back on top of college football, considering the way it ended at Florida. It almost looked like he may have been out of coaching for good.
Yeah, it did. And, you know, and look, he has told this story all over and over again about how he reordered his priorities and has better balance in his life now. And, look, I don't have any reason to disagree with that or dispute his stories, although I think probably a college football coach's idea of what constitutes a good balance probably isn't the same as yours, mine, or anybody listening on the radio. But yeah, that makes this whole thing even more interesting because you're right. He built a fantastic program at Utah in short order. He rebuilt the Gators, and frankly, obviously he didn't have to be the guy after Cheeseburger. That was Ron Zook. But he frankly took them to a spot where they were at least as good as Cheeseburger ever had them. Then that thing did become a little unmanageable for him. And I think at Ohio State, he's found a completely different platform that's bigger, better than Florida. But I will tell you this. One of the things interesting about Urban Meyer is when you go to Ohio State, and this isn't why he left Florida, this isn't why he went to Ohio State, but you don't have to contend with Nick Saban in Alabama, except if you get to see him in the playoff. You don't have to contend with him day in and day out in your own league, which he was going to have to do had he stayed at Florida, because about the time he left was when Nick was really getting it going at Alabama. So that certainly helps. Didn't have to deal with it. Now, all that said, the Big Ten is now more difficult than the SEC is, other than Alabama. But it is kind of interesting how life choices take you places to where you can succeed sometimes.
Now, let's go to the other game for just a bit, because you mentioned not a lot of people giving Washington a chance, and for good reason. I mean, Alabama and their defense. Yeah, you got Alabama, their defense, and there is the perception that the Pac-12 and the way that those Oregon teams struggled in the trenches, and now with Washington coming in with a high-powered offense. But also, Chris Peterson, in a big game, in an underdog role, you start hearing about that famous Fiesta Bowl when he was at Boise State. Now, you you cover that Oklahoma team. You know as much about that game as anybody. Is there any similarities to that game compared to what we may see on Saturday?
Oh, yeah, there's some. I mean, look, I'll say it's a very imperfect comparison on several levels. One, yeah, Chris Peterson, everybody knows if you give him, you know, a month to prepare, blah, blah, blah. I get that. Well, he's not dealing with a chucklehead in Nick Saban either, right? Mm-hmm. They're going to be prepared. It's also, and by the way, you know, obviously Bob Stoops and those guys, they know how to prepare people too. But it's also not a situation where the other team is going to take you lightly or is less enthused to be at a bowl game or that kind of thing. This is the playoff. And I'm not suggesting necessarily that Oklahoma was unmotivated or whatever. Boise State didn't just win that on trick plays. They out-executed Oklahoma in every phase of the game for about 3.5 quarters. Then Oklahoma kind of came alive, and then Boise made the tricks to win the thing. But the other thing that's not a good comparison is this. Boise State did face a pretty big talent disparity with Oklahoma. While there's a talent disparity between Washington and Alabama, it's not nearly the gap that Boise State and Oklahoma had.
Mm-hmm.
And so this sort of little engine that could thing about Washington is crazy. People are not giving the Huskies their due for how talented they are. Now, Alabama's really, really good. Their defensive front seven is fantastic. They have been able to consistently get pressure all year long without a blitz. And while I think Washington's O-line is better than people give it credit for, I think that's the key. It's a key matchup in the game, and I think they're going to have a hard time against that Alabama front seven, just the front four as far as that goes. But if they get a little bit of time to Jake Browning, then I think there's every shot that those guys will score on Alabama. And, you know, people don't pay any attention to how good Washington's defense has been either. And so, look, you have to make Alabama the favorite in that game. But Washington can flat play. And, you know, from having spent time out covering the Pac-12, as you know, I understand that a lot of people don't get how good teams are sometimes coming out of the Pac-12. Washington looks like a big-time elite football team. And, you know, the only other thing I would say is this. Whatever happens this year, Chris Peterson's really only getting started with how he's building that program. But their talent already is beginning to stack up to those other elite teams. So I don't know if I actually answered your question or if I just kind of rambled on.
No, it was good. No, it was a solid. Listen, if you rambled that too far off track, you know I'm not afraid to jump in and cut you off.
Well, thanks.
When we used to do our radio show together, you used to just cut me off all the time. So
that's right. We used to just say anytime we were worried about stuff, we would just say BCS. And back in the day, that just lit the phone lines up. You remember that?
Isn't that crazy? When we were doing a show in 2007, all we had to do was either say BCS or Rick Neuheisel. Well, now both of which none of it works anymore.
Right.
Well, Rick Neuheisel is like a lovable,
beloved, funny figure.
Yeah.
And the BCS is it's such a bygone era that nobody's mad anymore.
I don't know if you've seen this story or not. It just popped up on Twitter, but I had to share it with you because it makes me laugh. One is just kind of how dumb some young men can be in college football, but also I don't know if this is good or bad PR for the sponsor of the bowl game, but Arkansas's Jeremy Sprinkle was suspected of trying to shoplift from Belk at the Belk Bowl, where they get a gift card from Belk.
It's not. It's even worse than that. It's a $450 gift card for Belk. Players, the football players are given. You can have up to $550 from the bowl as a gift in gifts. You know, mm-hmm. Value. And so they all got a Fossil watch, which I assume was the $100 version of it, and they all got $450 gift card to Belk. And this was during the official shopping spree where they basically set them loose in the Belk flagship store. There in the Charlotte area to go spend your $450. So $450, you know, free to you, buying whatever you want, clothes, whatever, isn't enough. You've got to go try to, like, you know, I don't know exactly what he did, but, you know, stuff clothes down your pants or something, you know, shoplift. And that's just crazy.
And again, like I said, I wonder if the good people from Belk, who pay an awful lot of money for that sponsorship, is all that happy with the PR they're going to get. They say there's no such thing as bad PR, but I don't know if this one rings true.
It's worse PR, obviously, for Jeremy Sprinkle and the Arkansas football program, for sure. But, yeah, no, that's not good. And, it just lends itself to a bunch of jokes. So, that's pretty wild, huh? It's just, I don't know. I mean, once you realize the details, the irony of you're in there to spend free money. Think about what any of us would do with a $450 gift card to a nice department store, right? And Belk obviously doesn't have stores in the Portland area.
But yeah, nobody out here knows what it is, but it's a department store. Yeah.
Think Macy's. Uh-huh. It's not, I don't think it's Nordstrom, but think Macy's, right? So now we're in big trouble. Somebody's going to call in, and I'm going to have disrespected Macy's. I get it, but. I mean, it's a nice department store. It's not a discount store, and you've got $450 to just go do whatever you want with, and yet you're like deciding you need more.
Like I said, funny things seem to happen in the month of December when you get between that last game of the season and the bowl game, and if you can get out unscathed, you're doing pretty good. George, hey, I really appreciate the time. Great talking to you again, my friend. Enjoy the game, and we will talk to you down the road.
All right. Thanks, Justin. Appreciate it. Enjoyed it.
All right. George Schroeder, USA Today in Phoenix, covering the Fiesta Bowl with Ohio State and Clemson. Coming up, third hour of the program, we're going to get into some Blazer talk last night. George Karl, throwing shade at Dame? That's right. I said throwing shade. Also, Kellen did something earlier today that I'm not mad about, but the more I think about it, I'm just disappointed in him. And we'll talk about whether or not he is a genius or a madman, as I say. Coming up next, big third hour of the BFT. Justin Myers in for Canzano, 750-1029 The Game.
I want you all to listen up. This is important stuff, all right?
John Canzano is on Sports Radio 750, The Game.
Okay. Here we go.
The bald-faced truth.
Call 503-417-7575 or 877-733-0750 or text to 64636.
Here we go in 3, 2.
Now, in for John Canzano, here's Justin Myers on 750 and 1029 FM, The Game.
George Karl's throwing shade at Damian Lillard. By the way, can you tell you how excited I am to be able to use the term throwing shade? So excited about it.
You're one of us now. Welcome to the millennial.
Is that a millennial phrase, or is that more of a cool guy phrase?
Cool guy.
Yeah, okay. Let me throw out a couple of things. While I know your millennial culture is all about not putting labels on people and everybody's important and everybody is special, I don't care who you are. In any society, there are cool people and there are nerds.
I will counter with the fact that these kids didn't buy their own participation trophies. They were handed to us from the generation before.
That we agree on. But what I'm saying is your generation of we don't put labels on people and everybody is special, that yes, it was handed down by the parents who didn't want anybody to feel. There are still cool people and they're still nerds. All right?
Totally.
It's just the way life works. You could sit there and say, oh, we don't put labels on people, but it's still the way the world works.
I do feel like I'm too old to be adopting some of the phrases I do hear.
You're far too old to be a millennial, by the way. I don't buy that for a minute.
Yeah, I feel like that too.
We're both 83, and I think we've had this conversation before. I do not ever feel like a millennial. I have 3 children, and the oldest is going to be 10 in a couple months.
You probably act older than I do. Like, I'm a good 4 or 5 years older than you, and I'm sure you are probably way more have a whole lot more responsibility than I do.
Well, I would say that each child you have probably adds like 3 to 5 years onto your life.
Have you bought participation trophies before?
Yeah, for the kids?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. The basketball team, yeah, they ask for $10 to give the kids trophies
to give
at the pizza party.
Did they win a championship?
They won.
Did you guys keep score?
No.
Oh, my goodness.
No, they don't. It's like a, this is like
okay,
a learning.
How old are the kids?
One of them just turned 8 and the other one will be 10 in March.
So yeah, that 8 or 9, that's still old enough to keep score in a game, I would say.
I think so, especially for the 9-year-old.
Yeah.
I would think. I don't know. I was kind of surprised they didn't keep score.
So they didn't keep score, and everybody got a trophy, and everybody won.
Well, here's the thing, though. In their defense, like, our team was kind of like a bunch of misfits. And you can actually, as a coach, you can actually sign up kids that you've already coached. So there is probably, out of the eight teams, I would say about five of them, you could tell, had played together for several years. Like, some of these kids were pretty good, and our kids were, like, running around like they didn't know what was happening.
I think paying for the trophy is an honorary induction into the previous generation, based on what we were saying. Welcome.
So, okay, so because he bought a participation trophy and then handed it out, he's then become a Gen Xer?
Yeah, and the millennialhood passes on to his child.
And so they will then grow up feeling entitled and that they should always win and that there's never any consequences.
Not necessarily.
Don't try very hard. You're going to get a trophy anyways. You're fine.
No, because
don't worry about it. Life just hands you things.
I was trying to think whether or not I have any participation trophies. I think I might have thrown them away later, like when I was still a kid. Like, I know this is... I only kept the first place ones, you know?
Yeah.
You can't impress anybody with a participated. But I don't feel like I grew up entitled. I mean, if we lost, my participation trophy was like an ice pack. And
was an ice pack?
Yeah. Here you go. Did you ice grow that down, loser.
Did you have to ice your joints down? Did you grow up as a 40-year-old man?
I've got that Benjamin Button thing going on. No, but you know,
you came home from a hard day of T-ball and needed an ice pack and some Advil.
Well, the problem with my team was we were all show offs, and like we had kids who would like try to blow their helmet off even though they're running, they're topping out at like 12 miles an hour. You know, we were sliding into every base, regardless. The ball's still out in the outfield, you're still sliding in.
So no organization, no structure at all whatsoever.
No, like Gliss was saying, we were the Bad News Bears.
But see, you were like me. You were from a small timber town. In Southern Oregon, we were like, it was hardcore. We didn't mess around there.
No. And we were a little behind the times as far as, you know, catching up to the cultural
thoughts.
Yeah. No internet. It took a few years for the culture to reach us.
Either way, regardless, as we now attempt to steer this thing back on track, George Karl's throwing shade at Damian Lillard. That's how this whole thing got started.
Right.
Yes. Because we had to determine whether throwing shade was a millennial phrase or is it just a cool guy phrase.
Oh, it's brutal.
But George Karl, unprompted, by the way, on his book tour, he is just making friends left and right. You want to know how to make friends? Let's talk to George Karl. I always liked George Karl as a coach. He seemed like a good dude. But apparently he's a very, very angry man. He's a lot of pent-up frustration, and when doing an interview, I think, with New York Magazine, out of nowhere, unprompted, just decides that it's Damian Lillard's fault that the Blazers are struggling this year. He said, yeah, take a look at the Blazers. That team was focused, motivated a year ago, and I know Terry Stotts, so what's changed? So he says that Damian Lillard has gotten too much attention and that it is his fault that this team is now unmotivated and was on a six-game losing streak. It's all Dame's fault. We could sit here and bash George Karl for the next 10 minutes and it would probably be an awful lot of fun and call him a grumpy old man and stop with the get off my lawn stuff, but let me throw this out. Let's ponder if anything that he said actually holds water. So if you were to put a percentage, right? The Blazers are underperforming. Forget whether you think the expectations were realistic or not. And I know that they won last night, and I don't want to sit here. I want to throw shade on what happened last night. But the Blazers, as we sit right now, are underperforming. If you were to put a percentage on it, what percent is Damian Lillard's responsibility? Because I don't think you can be a team superstar, and if that team is struggling, you take zero blame. That's just not how life works. That's just not reality. It's common sense tells you that it doesn't work that way. But we love our superstars, and we don't want to criticize them. So while I disagree with George Karl's complete premise that it is all Damian Lillard's fault and that somehow, some way, him getting endorsements and getting attention off the court has become somewhat of a distraction as to why this team is failing. But what percentage would you put it at? How much responsibility does Damian Lillard have in the failings of this team so far, the underperforming of this team, and how much is on him to get this team back to winning? Is it 50%? Is it 25%? I mean, he does own some responsibility. He is an all-star. He is the superstar of this team. And if he wants to graduate to a level that Curry, LeBron, I would say Blake Griffin, you know, that those guys are at, when the Cavs struggle, does anybody look at the coach? No. It's all on LeBron. I mean, did Steve Kerr take a lot of the blame for the failure of holding a 3-1 lead last year's finals, or was it on Steph Curry? I mean, Steph Curry's the one that does a commercial now that talks about how he need the failing of going 73-9 and not getting a ring. That one's going to be on Steph Curry more than it'll ever be on Steve Kerr. So what responsibility does Damian Lillard have? If I were to put a percentage on it, 30%? 30? To me, I still think one of the biggest issues that this team has is that too many guys, I think, got contracts who aren't performing. That's on O'Shea. That's on the front office. That's not on Dame. But when you have a team that is struggling defensively, your best player needs to step up and play better defense. And I think we can all agree Lillard hasn't done that. Glitz, where are you at on this? If you were to look at the responsibility that Dame has for the underperforming of this team and maybe heading forward in the season, where's his responsibility percentage at?
I think you're in the right ballpark. I would probably go a little less, maybe around 20%.
20%?
Yeah. I mean, he's the best player, but there's five guys on the court. Every player is supposed to have some kind of role on the team. Then you have the coaches and even the general manager, Neil O'Shea. I think he deserves some responsibility as well. He's the one that put the roster together.
I mean, I think the majority of responsibility to fix it going forward, I think that's on Terry Stotts, obviously. I think a lot's going to be in the front office because they need to make a roster move. This team wants to make the playoffs and has any chance of winning in the first round of the playoff means you have to get out of the 8 seed. You probably have to get out of the 7 seed too. If you're going to do that and go on a run, this roster, I just don't see it. Maybe a light bulb will flash and a couple of guys will start playing better defense, and maybe when you see a couple of guys coming back, they can get things turned around. I don't see it with this roster. But I do think Lillard is going to have to own some of the responsibility, because if you want to be a bona fide superstar, it's not a free lunch. It comes with baggage. This is what you have to deal with. Whether it was fair or not of George Karl to come out and bash Damian Lillard and say that it's his fault that the team's not performing, that's a reality of a superstar in the league, isn't it? I mean, when the Knicks are bad, who takes the blame? It's Carmelo Anthony every single time. Has anybody blamed Phil Jackson for not turning around the Knicks? No, because it's Carmelo Anthony. When the Heat didn't win the championship, it's on LeBron. It's not on Eric Spoelstra. It's on LeBron. And I would say, I mean, last year, I think a prime example of that is when Blake Griffin broke his hand punching out an equipment manager, and the Clippers suffered because of it. Because if you're going to be a superstar, you have to own that responsibility. It's weird to hear it, though, I mean, this is kind of the first time we've heard anybody truly come out, really a basketball person, come out and truly criticize Damian Lillard. He's kind of been, you know, the darling of the NBA. I mean, there's going to be bad games and maybe a bad stretch here and there. But, I mean, when was, I mean, is this the first time we've heard anybody that, and say what you want about George Karl. The man knows the NBA. He knows basketball. Was it unfair for him to put the blame on Damian Lillard? Yeah, I do. And I love, by the way, Terry Stotts' reaction. It's like, you need to stay in your lane. But I think for the first time, Damian Lillard and I think a lot of Portland fans are realizing this is the baggage that comes with having a superstar on your team. It comes with unfair criticism and unfair pressure. I mean, LeBron would just be laughing at this because LeBron could go to the finals, not win, have absolutely nobody around him and take all of the blame. Now, LeBron actually deserves a lot of the blame because he's played not only power forward, but head coach and GM for like the last 4 years. But if you were to look at O'Shea, Stotts, Dame, this team gets turned around. Who's it going to be on? Let's say they do. Let's be a little more positive. Let's look ahead to 2017. Let's say the Blazers figure it out and turn it around. Who's going to get the credit?
I would say it's probably Terry Stotts.
And, you think Stotts will get the credit?
And Damian Lillard. I mean, I think you're right. The star player is going to kind of take the responsibility, whether it's the negative or the positive, for the most part. But I think if they kind of do what they did last year and all of a sudden January hits and they turn it around, I do think Terry Stotts will get some credit for that as well.
Does Dame have enough of a leadership mentality?
I think he does.
I think so, too, but it's... I think it's kind of hit and miss sometimes.
I think he has good leadership qualities, but I don't think he has a true number two guy next to him. I think that's part of what the Blazers are lacking.
Are you throwing shade on CJ McCollum now?
I love CJ. I think he's great, but is he a perennial all-star? I don't think so. I mean, Damian has been a borderline all-star in the past, so.
No, I mean it is a good point. I mean, when you look at what is around Damian Lillard, and you can only do so much on the floor, and that's where before they went on this horrific December, I looked at the team and was like, you know, this is way too early in the season for Damian Lillard to have to work this hard to win games. I mean, if you go back to the games that they win and just how much he had to do and how he had to take over, it was way too early in the season for Damian Lillard to take over and win games. And I was wondering if he was going to hit a wall. I think there's a little bit to that in this bad month. I think there's also some bad luck. I think some tough scheduling. And a team that has been figured out that they can't play a lick of defense.
I think that's a great point as well, because if you look at the beginning of the year, even when things were going okay, I mean, they were playing some bad teams that they were having to go, you know, to the last couple minutes. Yes. And Dame was having to score like 35 plus points a game. And a lot of people were talking about, oh, he's on a MVP campaign. But it's like, wait a minute, if he has to score 35 points a night against bad teams, that's not a good sign for your basketball team.
No, I mean, and it would be one thing if it was March or even February after the All-Star break, where, you know, you're trying to jockey for position in the playoffs and you're working to get to a better seed. But the fact that the first month of the season, your superstar had to go for broke in the fourth quarter just to get you wins. You just wonder if he kind of hit just a little mid-season brick wall, a little mid-season funk. But I do think, though, that this is the tip of the iceberg, gang. This is where you have to kind of buck up and realize that when you have a superstar, and listen, I love Brandon Roy, but I think Dame's a bigger superstar than Brandon Roy was. I mean, Dame's the biggest superstar we've seen on the Blazers since who? I mean, who was the last guy, Gliss, at Damian Lillard's level, I would superstar-wise?
I would say Drexler, but I think that Damian is the biggest superstar that Portland's ever had in terms of the whole package. And, you know, for what we consider a superstar nowadays,
yeah,
marketability, personality, just, you know, he's out there doing all these different things outside of basketball, whether it's Foot Locker or the Madden commercial a couple of years ago. He has the personality of that larger-than-life athlete.
You're saying that Clyde Drexler's Avia shoes didn't have that marketability? Can't believe Avia never made it into the basketball market with Clyde the Glide.
And to be fair, you know, it was kind of a different time. I think,
absolutely was.
You know, right. Now if you have those qualities, you become a superstar if you can back it up on the court. Whereas Clyde, I mean, there was no question he could back it up on the court.
He's a top 50 player in the NBA history. I mean, other than Jordan, he was a top tier shooting guard in the league. And I still think Drexler is the Blazers' biggest superstar. Now, part of it is because when I was growing up, I was right in the middle of it, right in the middle of the Rip City Blazers. And the discussion and the debate, even though it doesn't seem silly now, but you would never make it, was back then it was, is Drexler as good as Jordan? Because Drexler had been to the finals in 89. Jordan hadn't been to the finals. He couldn't get Chicago over the hump. And that was the discussion. I don't think there's ever a discussion, is Damian Lillard on the same page as Stephen Curry? This is not there. But that team, the Blazers, had different time. You're absolutely right, Gliss. But also, I mean, Terry Porter, Jerome Kersey was a better surrounding cast than what you have now.
Those were solid teams. And that in the 91 season might have been the best shot that they had when they lost to the Lakers.
To the Lakers, yeah. Coming up next, I'm going to ask I've been teasing this the entire show. I think that Kellen is an absolute madman. Gliss thinks he's a genius. We will continue the debate coming up next. It's the BFT, Justin Myers, in for Canzano, 750, 1029 The Game.
This is the Bald-Faced Truth with guest host Justin Myers on 750 The Game.
Final segment of the BFT before we hand it off to Chop. By the way, the Birmingham Bowl, which, you know, all the tradition of bowl season. I mean, the Birmingham Bowl. I can remember growing up, getting up early, watching the Birmingham Bowl with my dad. But South Florida has just taken a 46-39 lead over South Carolina. But this bad boy is in overtime. South Florida, like, gave up I think they had, at one point, had a 19-point lead in the fourth quarter. South Carolina came roaring back. But the Birmingham Bowl is in overtime right now on ESPN. So I came in earlier today. And me, Gliss, were sitting back and kind of mapping out the show and kind of figuring out where we're going to fit some certain topics in. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, we see through the window, we see Kellen ripping apart his sausage McMuffin with eggs. And you created a monster sausage McMuffin.
That's right.
So what you did, just so we can get this, I want to be accurate. I don't want to, because I'm disappointed in what you did, but I don't want to make any false claims. So what you did is you took two sausage McMuffin with eggs. You then took off one half of the English muffin of each of them and then comboed it together. So you had two sausage patties, two eggs, two cheese on the one English muffin.
It's tricky because you can't peel off the side that has the melted cheese
on
it.
No, you don't want to lose any of the cheese.
No, they are now one cohesive unit.
So absolutely.
You got to peel off the muffin from the egg side, and every egg McMuffin is created equal. They all look identical. So two of them have egg.
Okay, first off, this was a sausage McMuffin with egg.
Sausage McMuffin.
Very different than an egg McMuffin.
If you buy one, they're like three and change like 360 or 370. But if you get two, they're only $4. So, I mean, what am I going to do?
Listen,
not throw in the change for the second one?
Let me preface this.
I'm a value buyer.
I am not judging you on the amount of sausage McMuffins that you ate. That is not the judgment here. The judgment that I have is that for me, the essence of the sausage McMuffin with egg is the muffin.
Oh, okay.
And you threw away one perfectly good English muffin.
Well, I didn't want a carbo load. I'm proteins,
really?
Man. High proteins. I'm clearly a protein eater.
You created a monster McDonald's breakfast sandwich, and you're worried about your carbs.
So top to bottom ingredients, muffin, cheese, sausage, egg, egg, sausage, cheese, muffin.
Yes.
Beautiful.
No,
the
it's
only
not.
Thing, missing cheese in the middle. I will
why
give you that.
Why wouldn't you just eat one and then eat another?
Because the muffin's filling. It is really filling.
Dude, you've had like 15 Nutter Butters in the last 3 hours.
Those are delicious, though. And like I've said, those are more of a delivery vehicle for the coffee.
You sat and ate cookies for the last 3 hours.
I couldn't eat.
If you were watching carbs, then I could absolutely understand. But you've been hammering cookies for the last 3 hours.
Peanut butter cookies, also high protein.
They're not high in protein. I would throw the challenge flag on that.
I could never drink 3 thermoses full of coffee without Nutter Butters. Those are my assists. You know,
that is the weirdest. That is one of the top 5 weirdest food things I've ever heard.
I couldn't do it with Oreos. If I was eating Oreos alongside cookies, I'd be done.
Okay.
Like, way too sweet.
I have been in situations where the food that I'm eating is dictated by the beverage or vice versa. The food I'm eating dictates the beverage. I don't think I've ever had a beverage dictate the food I eat. That's some backwards thinking there.
I know you're saying it. Yeah,
you
I
said
had to
you,
do the
you,
science on that one.
Now, when I have pizza, I want a beer.
Right.
When I eat Oreos, I want a glass of milk.
Yep.
When I movie theater popcorn, I want soda.
Right.
I have never had a beverage and decide, you know what? I can't drink this entire thing if I don't have 8 Nutter Butters to go along with it.
That's true.
I've never heard of that before, to where your beverage has dictated the food you eat. It's always the opposite.
I'm trying to think if there's another situation where this has happened.
It's not, no, there isn't one. Ripley's Believe It or Not, we figured it out. You're the only person that needs food to get through a thermos full of coffee.
Yeah, that really is. But I will get, like, you know, I'll get a slice of like one of their flavored bread loaves from Starbucks,
uh-huh.
You know, the gingerbread or pumpkin bread or whatever.
Sure.
And that usually helps me get down the first coffee.
You can't drink coffee without food.
Well, if I've eaten breakfast, I'm okay. But today I had to skip breakfast, which doesn't even make sense.
No, you did. First
I
off,
have two McMuffins.
You did not skip breakfast.
Yeah.
You ate 2 sausage McMuffin with eggs, and then you ruined them by ripping the McMuffin out.
It might just be force of habit now. I'm just going through the motions. Maybe I'm trying to get myself thirsty enough, like peanuts at a bar or like the bowl
yes.
of popcorn, get myself uh-huh. thirsty enough to where I have to drink coffee because I do need the energy. I just don't
Except
like
for I
coffee.
Don't think that's how sugar works.
No.
I don't think it is. Now, Gliss, you said he was being a genius by making the super McMuffin.
I thought it was pretty amazing. I used to get 2 sausage McMuffins all the time in my younger 20s when I had no money and was often hungover.
And nothing but metabolism working for you?
Yeah, and I never thought that I could just have all that food on one sandwich. I would have totally done it. I might have to go try this at some point to see how this works out because I'm not going to lie. I mean, I get that the McMuffin or whatever is an important part, but you still
it's
have
the
it there.
Essence.
It's just you get a bigger sandwich.
Okay. Well, then what's... This is like 2 pair or 3 of a kind. You know what I mean? But it's... I would much rather have 2 sandwiches than 1 big sandwich. You know what I mean?
Well, here...
The best part of the sandwich is the bread. That's the best part of the sandwich.
When you initially told me you had doubts about my genius, I went ahead
and... Well, first off, that goes without saying.
I went ahead and came into the studio and cranked up the mic because, as I showed you guys earlier, when you squish the sandwich together, it makes this very appetizing noise. Now, this is not me making noises. This is egg on egg.
Yeah, that's you just playing with your food.
Here's
is
the
what
bite.
You were doing. That's disgusting.
I mean,
please, can we delete that, by the way, forever? Can you never play that again? That's disgusting. It is so gross.
Yeah.
What did you do today? I squished two pieces of egg together and then took a bite and recorded it. Called it producing.
Delicious. You're okay. This time, I feel fortunate because today I didn't do what I usually do, which is apply strawberry jelly into it as well.
Into what?
Into the sandwich.
Wait, no, hold on.
Double up the McMuffin.
No, stop. Stop right now. Strawberry jelly?
Yeah.
That is just, oh my God.
Who eats an English muffin without some jelly?
Yeah. Nobody.
Now you lost me.
Gliss was on it until that last one.
Hey, follow me
a
off
bridge
the cliff.
Too far.
I'm clearly already a genius.
No,
according
you're not.
To your words.
No, you're not. You're an absolute madman who has ruined now. Lord knows how many sandwiches you have ruined over the last since before I even knew you.
That's the line. Like, I was with him when he put them together, but once he applied the jelly, I was off this bus.
But seriously, I cannot understand the thought behind put. Jelly on an egg on a sausage McMuffin with okay, egg.
Here's
That's so gross.
Look at
that
the
is
typical
so disgusting.
A typical continental breakfast.
Yes.
You got your eggs, your breakfast meat,
uh-huh.
your toast,
Without
your jelly.
A doubt, yes.
Just put them all together, man.
Why would you do that?
Convenience?
No, it's not. As a matter of fact, it is much more inconvenient to then take something that the good folks at McDonald's had already built for you and then rebuild it.
Yeah.
It is not convenient. It is the opposite of convenient.
It's a slap in the face to all
you
those
really
MIT
did.
Physicists.
First
down
off,
at McDonald's.
Hey, those hardworking people are putting sandwiches together for you and I.
And I appreciate it.
Absolutely. No, you don't appreciate it. Again, lies. You don't. You take what they have built. And you think you can do better, and you can't.
Well, I asked
and then
them
you
if,
ruin
they,
it.
If they would do it at the counter, and they wouldn't. They're
because
like, no,
nobody
can
comprehend why you would take two perfectly good sandwiches and then make one big one, and then throw half of it away.
That's true.
It's all true. I'm hopefully getting through here. I'm hoping this is a breakthrough for you.
My only sin.
You ruined two breakfast sandwiches.
My only sin is being born so far ahead of my time.
No. It's exactly the opposite, as a matter of fact.
You guys wait and see. I'm going to make a food truck, and I'm only going to serve doubled up breakfast sammies.
Now, from McDonald's?
Okay. No. See, again, Kellen, I hate
it my way.
I hate to keep throwing cold water on your ideas here, but that's not what you did. If you were to go to McDonald's and buy a doubled up sandwich, then I'd be like, hey, more power to you. The double quarter pounder, for instance. But that's not what you did. So you are going to open a food truck, give people two sandwiches, and then make them make it as they walk out. It's a brilliant business idea.
I don't think I'd make it. I would put together a sandwich for them.
I know you would,
oh,
but that's
then
not
they'll
what you
separate
did,
it in.
But that's not what you did. Do you see my point here?
Yeah. Nobody understands.
No, that's why the more I thought about it, the more I was like, you just took a great English muffin and threw it away.
I did.
Because
yeah.
That's the best part of the breakfast sandwich is the English muffin.
I will say, yeah, I did. Creating this genius forced me to throw away two halves. So I did toss in.
Okay, so if we're going to look at McDonald's breakfast sandwiches, just in terms of the carbs that are bind them together, if we're to power rank them, you've got the English McMuffin. There's the biscuit for the sausage biscuit and cheese. And then there's the McGriddle, which is essentially a big pancake. If you were to power rank those 1, 2, 3, which way do you go? Hot take, by the way, I go McMuffin number one.
I mean, I like the sausage McMuffin that he had.
You would have liked to have had the party threw away?
Next time, I'll save it for you guys.
You know, that part you threw away, I would have loved to have had that.
You'd probably put jelly on the English muffin if it wasn't in the McMuffin, though, right?
I don't put jelly on. I don't want anything sweet for breakfast. Only savory.
So I'm looking at the calories for the Egg McMuffin.
Don't do that. I've done that. It's a bad
yeah,
idea.
Why, yeah. It's just, again, remember the coffee creamer theory I had yesterday?
Right.
We just don't want to know.
So it's 67 calories in an English muffin,
uh-huh.
300 calories overall in the Egg McMuffin. So rather than eating 600 calories, I ate 533.
Mm-hmm. How about you cut out 10 Nutter Butters and just eat two sandwiches.
Oh, those are way more delicious. Also, I saved myself probably, what, like 30 minutes on a treadmill? 60 calories?
No, you didn't.
Boom. I worked out today.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it is. I actually did. One time I was trying to be health conscious, and I did look at the McDonald's breakfast menu because I really wanted something from there. And I realized it was pointless. I was like, oh, there has to be something on here that's reasonable. There's not. Once you go in, it's.
Yeah. See, that's the thing. I love fast food, and in particular, McDonald's. I do. I'm equal opportunity when I binge. I try to eat healthy as much as possible, but when I go into the deep end, I go to the deep end. So that's maybe why I'm bringing my own bias here, because I would, if I'm going to break my healthy food habit, I'm going all in, and I'm not going to throw away two perfectly good halves of an English muffin.
Now, speaking of the breakfast items, McDonald's came through and they handed us this experimental item they have, which is
experimental items.
It's a grilled or a fried chicken breast in a McGriddle.
Yeah.
So it's essentially like the chicken and waffle.
Yes.
Sandwich.
Without a doubt. That's great.
You're cool with that, though? I'm
100% cool with that.
Some Frankenstein sandwich.
No, that's chicken and waffles. Have you ever had chicken and waffles? They're delicious.
Yeah, no, they are pretty amazing.
Would you ruin it by putting jelly on it?
I might dip it in gravy.
Well, yes. That's not disgusting.
These standards are not consistent.
No, just don't put jelly on it. Like a crazy person.
I don't know, man. Jelly's delicious. It's definitely my favorite fruit.
Listen, ice cream's delicious. Would you put that on there, too?
No.
Oh, no. I'm giving him ideas
that's
now.
That's disgusting.
Oh, my goodness gracious. I'm giving him ideas now.
No, that's just unreasonable.
Let's go to Roy. Roy is in Salem. What's on your mind, Roy?
Hey, guys. Hey, Kellen, more power to you, man. I do the same thing with the bacon, egg, and cheese McGriddle, but I don't throw away the other half or the other McGriddles. I just eat them later.
Oh, yeah. You can't throw away McGriddle.
No.
All right. Hey, Roy, I appreciate the phone call. Thanks for calling in.
I have the popular vote on my side.
No,
here.
You don't. You have Roy on your side, and he he kind of agreed with me anyways because you threw away the English muffin part, right?
Yeah, I did.
Threw it away. He says he saves them for later.
Yeah, that's actually a very valid point that you probably didn't think of, is that you could have saved those to have later. Where are they now?
They're in. I'm going to find him digging through trying to get them. No, I just toss them in the bin. But who wants a cold English muffin? Not this guy.
That's a good point.
Wait, they don't have a toaster back there?
No, I don't think so.
See, again,
in the break room?
But it wouldn't have lasted long. It wouldn't have lasted with me. I would have just hammered two sandwiches.
The thing with the McGriddle is, though, they're gorgeous little pancakes with syrup nuggets all over inside them.
Yes.
Little bursts of joy.
No, I'm with you.
Never throw that out.
But the English muffin? Nah, I only need half of that.
Peasant food.
That's what it is. It's just your snobbery. I don't know. Again, the more we talk about this, the more ridiculous it seems of what you just did earlier.
I mean, it's kind of making me hungry for another one.
I'm kind of hungry right now, too.
I have breakfast all day.
I can't do it. I can't do that, man. I'm a traditionalist when it comes to Mickey D's or really anywhere. It just 11 o'clock hits and it's I can't do it. Can't order it. The only time I would ever break ranks is if it was late night and I was maybe got a good buzz going.
Yeah.
Oh, then
yeah.
I want breakfast sandwiches.
Where it feels like breakfast and it's like 1 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah. Like that's when I would break ranks. But like, again, my point is if I'm going to break and go to a fast food, I'm not going to get breakfast stuff. I'm going to get a burger.
Yeah. You know, a lot of restaurants will throw an egg on the burger for you.
That's good. I've had that before.
Yeah.
Yeah. You put a fried egg on a burger.
Fried eggs, some bacon.
All of that is great.
You get half an omelet on your burger.
You know what I wouldn't do? Put jelly on it like a crazy person.
No! Jelly on a burger? That's just out of line. I have had peanut butter on a bacon burger, though. It's also delicious.
When you said you put jelly on your breakfast sandwich, you've lost me. You've lost me forever. You've lost all credibility in the sandwich game. You got to build it back up.
I'll always have Roy, though.
Yes, you will. You and Roy from Salem can go hang out together and just throw away perfectly good halves of sandwiches.
Jelly up these sandwiches.
You know what? This is not a better way to end the program on that. My thanks to George Schroeder from USA Today, also Tyson Alger of the Oregonian. Of course, Kellen Gliss, Dustin's back there, and Chop coming up next. He'll take you all the way till 7. This has been the BFT. I'm Justin Myers, filling in for Canzano, 750-1029 The Game.